loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we'll talk about the two major immigration stories in the courts and a major blow to the Trump administration's immigration policy. Another federal judge has ruled that attempts to end the popular Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, is illegal. The judge is ruling that this program must continue. Also, the Muslim ban finally reaches the Supreme Court today and was heard this morning. All three versions of the Muslim ban have been ruled unconstitutional at every level of the federal courts so far. But what will happen with the Supreme Court right-wing majority in command? And then we continue our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, where we take a look at nuclear issues, including nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, nuclear waste, and the future of nuclear technology and the United States.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, busloads of Central American migrants arrived in Tijuana, Mexico yesterday, where they intend to turn themselves into U.S. border authorities and to ask for asylum. Most of the migrants are from Honduras and are fleeing crime, violence, and political repression in that country. The Trump administration, however, is warning that anybody without a valid claim will be swiftly deported, and anybody who tries to cross the border will be arrested and prosecuted. Next, a Filipino human rights activist scheduled to speak across the country was detained upon arrival at San Francisco Airport and will likely be deported today. A Customs and Border Protection officer said there was a problem with Jaron Abba's visa, but Abba maintains that customs officers planted a weapon on him and tortured him while he was first detained. Then the Taliban announced the start of their annual spring offensive today, dismissing an offer of peace talks by President Ashraf Ghani and pledging to focus on attacking only U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Ghani had called for peace talks without any preconditions, but the Taliban refused, calling the offer a conspiracy. And then Pakistan's former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is on trial in that country on myriad corruption charges. He and his family have been major political players in Pakistan for most of the last 30 years and have been accused of corruption before. But allegations of Sharif having assets beyond his means, leaked as part of the Panama Papers, may be enough to finally put him in prison. And finally, Facebook yesterday made public for the very first time a 27-page memo explaining the criteria for banning content on its site. The company also said that it would be more clear about its privacy policies in light of a new European Union law mandating transparency. And in other headlines, after President Donald Trump backed away from his nominee to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs yesterday at a press conference, Dr. Ronnie Jackson seemed to be staying the course. Overprescribing medications and being drunk while working are two accusations that have come to light this week, and his nomination is facing opposition from veterans groups and members of Congress who complain about his lack of managerial experience. In the midst of the U.S.-China trade war, Apple CEO Tim Cook is heading to the White House to discuss the issue with Donald Trump. Apple relies on China to manufacture many parts of its products. Although Cook has not publicly commented on what they will discuss, the president tweeted this morning, quote, "We will be talking about many things, including how the U.S. has been treated unfairly for many years by many countries on trade," unquote. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has rejected the idea of negotiating a new nuclear deal. Speaking today in the Iranian city of Tabriz, Rouhani said, quote, "We will not add anything to the deal or remove anything from it, even one sentence. The nuclear deal is the nuclear deal," unquote. The idea of reaching a new accord between major world powers and Iran was floated by French President Emmanuel Macron during his meeting with Donald Trump yesterday. The Department of Housing and Urban Development proposed significant changes today to its rental assistance program. Under the reforms, renters would have to pay 35% of their income as opposed to the current 30%, and authorities would be able to impose work requirements on recipients of housing aid. The proposal from HUD now goes to Congress. Those are today's headlines. Next up is the Supreme Court's deliberations on immigration. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Supreme Court hearing on the issue of the Muslim ban and also on the status of DACA. In a major blow to the Trump administration's immigration policy, another federal judge has ruled that attempts to end the popular Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, are illegal. However, the judge gave the administration 90 days to appeal the decision. Meanwhile, the Muslim ban finally reaches the Supreme Court today. All three versions of the Muslim ban have been ruled unconstitutional at every level of the federal courts. Now it's the Supreme Court's turn to weigh in. We're joined from Baltimore by attorney Heather Benno. She's an immigrant rights activist and attorney. And we're joined from Chicago by Angie Kim. She is the Community Engagement and Advocacy Coordinator for the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium. And Angie is herself one of the dreamers. Angie and Heather, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Angie Kim, let's start with you. How did you feel? How did you react with this latest twist in the case of DACA with the federal court ruling?
The decision definitely comes with a lot of mixed emotions, to be honest, Brian. You know, I do believe that this is definitely a step in the right direction. You know, this is a judicial win for our undocumented immigrant communities, and really just solidifies, you know, the inhumane ways in which the Trump administration rescinded the program. However, you know, as you mentioned, this does not issue an acceptance of new application for the time being. The judge did, you know, issue a stay of 90 days, the next 3 months, for the administration to come up with, you know, an argument, and I'm pretty sure that they will, an attempt to end the program yet again. So, you know, we're hopeful, but this is not the end and be all solution for our communities.
Angie, before we turn to Heather, I want to just ask you a quick follow-up question. So new people cannot apply if they're not already part of the DACA program. It doesn't open them. But for you, I mean, you came here, I believe, as a 9-year-old. You're now in your 30s. What's the direct impact on you, or in terms of your own perception of what's going to happen with you?
Well, you know, I was lucky enough to you know, to be able to apply for the DACA program when it initially first came out in 2012, and I've been renewing for the past 5 years. And I was able to renew my application right before the rescission. However, you know, this doesn't provide a permanent solution for me. This does not provide a pathway to citizenship for me. And, you know, we right now, with the level of threat that the community is dealing with the current administration is so vast that, you know, DACA is just one of the issues. You know, we have seen rampant activities with ICE raids that happened recently in Tennessee as well as across the country. So this is, you know, I'm still living under, you know, threat and uncertainty, and my life continues to be in a limbo.
It must be. I can't imagine going through something like this, Brian, where you're trying to be an activist for a cause that's very important. You're trying to help other people. And at the same time, you're under the same kind of threat, the same kind of danger that they are. And then you finally get in front of the Supreme Court and you're met with hostility. It's just not the American way.
Heather Benno, you're an attorney. You represent people from in all sort of categories who are immigrants. In other words, not just young people, but people of all walks of life. Again, let's take your what's your take on the federal district court ruling, and also how are the people you're representing? How are they reacting? I mean, this is like a yo-yo that goes up and down. There must be so much uncertainty and anxiety.
Thank you, Brian. Yes, our clients, and I practice in Baltimore, out of the Baltimore Immigration Court, which is the court responsible for deportations of anybody residing in the state of Maryland. So we're seeing all of the anxiety in the community, all of the confusion, and the opportunity, unfortunately, for fraud that happens because of the confusion. In this case, for example, I have a client who turned 15 in June of 2017. Under the DACA program, you weren't eligible to apply for the initial application until you actually turned 15. So many of the people who have been excluded from the prior federal court injunctions were just that, younger kids who otherwise would have qualified but hadn't reached the age yet or didn't have the money to apply yet or had dropped out of school for a time to work and are now re-enrolled in school. So I was able to file for this client an initial DACA application in June of last year. That said, just yesterday I got a call from the family because this application has still not been decided all the way up until today. So even though there have been so many months, September termination of the DACA program, and then December, January, we got, you know, two injunctions at a federal level requiring immigration to process renewal applications. And this time, we have another decision saying that it would be unlawful for immigration to continue rejecting these initial filings of young kids, but we're just going to give DHS another chance to correct itself. And so where does that leave the community? A lot of people, unfortunately, are throwing their hands in the air and saying, I really don't know what to do at this point.
John, you had, when we were talking about this earlier in the day, and let's ask Heather a follow-up question, you were saying, well, the court gave the Trump administration an additional 90 days to respond. That's, as you put it, a generous amount of time.
Yeah, I thought it was a generous amount of time. But then you made an important point that what it serves to do, at least at the circuit court level, is to allow an extra 90 days for people to at least begin the application process.
But this, but what Heather and Angie are telling us is you can't start it. You can't start the application.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Heather, go ahead on that.
Well, let me ask a specific point on that. So does this, I mean, we're pretty well-informed people and we're confused by this. What does this do in the community? Are other people confused by what the rules are as this thing works its way through multiple courts?
That is exactly the point. People are so scared and the stakes are so high to file one of these things without knowing the actual rule and how it'll be treated. We've all seen DACA recipients arrested at rallies, sometimes even in totally valid lawful status. So there's confusion about the program en masse. And while the court decisions, the injunctions are positive in that they open an opportunity, they open the window for people to get renewal applications in, on this particular point, Brian is correct in that actually we are not, initial applicants are not able to file their initial DACA applications at this time under the injunction. So the injunction is not actually in place. And in fact, that was because the federal court was relying on federal law that basically said that if too many people would be eligible and too many people would basically flood the system with applying, then that can create an administrative burden for the government. So it was actually partially just based on the interest of administrative efficiency, actually, that the court gave DHS essentially another chance. Okay, DHS, I've found, based on all of the explanations you've advanced, that there really is no rational explanation besides racism for this policy or for eliminating the program. So if you can articulate, it is a second chance. It is like kind of an extra credit assignment. You could see it that way. I'm going to give you 90 days to come up with something that makes sense. And if you don't, then we will definitively know that there's no reason for this termination. And so in that way, I do think that the order of the court was very confusing. And in some ways, while trying to balance the scales on the administrative efficiency issue, really ignored the humanitarian concerns of all of these people who would qualify.
Yeah, go ahead, Angie.
Yeah, I mean, those are very good points. I think, you know, as a person who's directly impacted, you know, I want to pull back a little and just, you know, a quick reminder that, you know, when Attorney General Jeff Sessions made the announcement to rescind the program, one of his arguments is that, you know, former President Obama had not constitutional authority to issue such an executive order that overrides the Congress. Then therefore, it is, you know, the responsibility of the Congress to come up with a permanent legislative solution. So, you know, with the decision to end the program by the Trump administration, they also have the responsibility to work with Congress to create this permanent solution. But what we have seen is we have seen lack of leadership and a willingness for the leaders of this country to do that. So
you know, frankly, we are tired of being, of our lives being politicized. We're tired of this back and forth and, you know, momentary, temporary, small wins. You know, like I said, this is a step in the right direction that we have the judicial system who are making the right, you know, arguments and the decisions. But this, like I said, you know, this doesn't implement it to our lives that actually creates a solution for us. So, you know, what we want is we want a permanent legislative solution. And that time has already been, you know, it's long overdue. And so I just want to remind that as much as this is a small victory, this is not the, you know, end and be all solution for our communities.
Heather, I want to turn back to you. There are reports today in all the major publications, they're all releasing these breaking news text messages and stuff saying that there does not appear to be a path through the Supreme Court, that the five conservative justices appear to be sticking together just based on the kinds of questions that they asked in the hearing today. Was that your impression as well? And also, I wanted to ask if you see any sort of legislative path through this in a Republican Congress with Donald Trump in the White House.
On your second point about whether there's a path, a legislative path, I do have to say that we can never predict the future. And I think in some ways, immigration is the best example of how no matter who is in the White House or no matter who controls Congress, the reality is that many times they're on the opposite side of the immigrant community or even regular, you know, working folks in the United States. And it's really up to mass movements or, you know, the people most affected to raise the issue and force legislation. And it reminds me of the 1990 Immigration Act when the Salvadoran community was fighting for the first time for temporary protected status as a result of the Civil War. And that was a time when there was large, in an effort to further restrict immigration. But in that statute, Congress carved out a special protection for anybody who was coming from a country that had been designated affected by a natural disaster or civil war, other of those terrible situations which we've been hearing about in the news. So in that particular time in 1990, it wasn't that, you know, immigration reform was really popular in the United States and, you know, everybody was on board. It just was the struggle of the Salvadoran community and all of the folks in the streets fighting for that form of protection that it was ultimately granted. So I do think that there are possibilities. And as we saw, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility that even some of the most conservative legislators or even racist people in the White House could eventually, under the right pressure, support immigration reform. George W. Bush supported immigration reform. I don't think that we would think that he's a friend to people of color. But, you know, that was the position that the Republican Party was forced into. And there are certain elements of the Republican Party that still criticize Trump on this point today. But I do believe that it's possible.
You know, there was a piece in today's Washington Post saying that the administration is preparing to expel people from Nepal who fled their country 3 years ago after a devastating earthquake. Just today, they were given 1 year to make their arrangements and get the heck out of the country. The administration also issued a statement this morning saying that the caravan that had arrived in Tijuana yesterday, that's mostly made up of Hondurans who are fleeing violence and crime and abuse in their own country, will not be permitted into this country. It seems to me, and I'm just opining here, it seems to me that this administration is so hostile that if there's going to be any positive change in policy, it's going to have to come from Congress, and it's going to have to be strong enough to override a presidential veto.
Yeah, let's talk about strategy a little bit with Angie Kim, because in many ways, it's the dreamers themselves, the activists like Angie, the organizers who have really changed the political climate such that President Obama even finally did DACA. That was a consequence of direct confrontation, mobilization. At least Obama did it, even if it was in a limited way. And since Trump came into office, the Dreamers have been right there continuing to fight in spite of all the ups and downs and dislocations and anxieties and uncertainties. The thing that's been remarkable to me, Angie, and I think this is part of the point that Heather was getting to, is that if we're looking for change, maybe it really just comes from below, finally, such magnitude that it changes the political climate or changes the decision making at the top, but it originates from below. What's the tactic now or the strategy now for the Dreamers?
Absolutely, and I want to get into it just by pointing out there was a recent massive, one of the largest raids at Morristown, Tennessee, at a meatpacking plant. It's about 100 people. What's fascinating about that is that the next day, the county had about 550 children who did not go to school. So the level of threat that we're experiencing is pretty profound. And the way that we have been responding is, see, the community did amazing rapid response and organizing work, and they have been able to help a lot of these families who were affected by this raid. And, don't forget that this is not the first, and we are expecting to continue to see this sort of a rampant threat to the community. And so the way we have been responding is we have been, organizing and engaging our communities on a whole new level. We have directly impacted folks like the Young Dreamers and undocumented communities coming together and really, building this very organized plan structure and plans in place to help each other and help each other to get out of these situations. So, I see this as also a beacon of light where these sort of situations have initiated a whole new level of community engagement, participation, and just support for each other. And we have been fighting on the political scale as well as within our community, educating our communities. We have, done a tremendous amount of legislative advocacy in the last couple of months, right through the CIR posting that happened about four times. And so, we're going to continue this effort. We're preparing a plan for communities to engage and protect ourselves from these threats. So, I'm hopeful, and I always mention this, is I see amazing leadership and amazing, grassroots, movement from our community members.
That's the voice of Angie Kim. She's the Community Engagement and Advocacy Coordinator for the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium. Angie came here when she was 9 years old. She's still undocumented, but now one of the DACA recipients. She's in her mid-30s. We're also joined from Baltimore by attorney Heather Benno, an immigrant rights activist and attorney in Baltimore representing immigrant clients. Heather, I know you have to run, but I want to ask you a quick question in our last couple minutes. What is clearly emerging is a strategy of fighting back whereby people from communities, political activists, people like yourself in the legal community, lawyers, are coming together for this multifaceted, multi-tiered defense effort of immigrant communities, and at the same time trying to build a political momentum for real change, for comprehensive immigration reform. What Angie mentioned about the raid and on the Tennessee factory, where all these workers were just hauled away, more than 100, and then the next day, all these kids didn't come to school because they were afraid. It shows, and I think this is the message that really has to be promoted, that in the name of keeping America safe, the American government, the U.S. government, is violating basic, fundamental human and social rights, and it has nothing at all to do with actually providing security or guarantees of security for the American people. That's the message that we have to fight against and the message we have to fight for as we wage this battle. Go ahead, Heather.
On the issue of the travel ban, for example, we're seeing actually illegal conduct, actually racist, kind of anti-Muslim sentiment motivating the policy. And, it's we're not really going into an area of hypotheticals here. We're talking about a Supreme Court that is willing to say that at least it appears to be a majority of the justices on the Supreme Court are willing to consider, anyway, a ban that is completely based on religion and facially has always been based on religion, as one that is reasonable and one that is somehow tied to security. And we did see some of the justices today challenge that by saying that really these policies, including the raids, including the bans, they're not, and you know, Justice Kagan is not a revolutionary either. She's a justice of the Supreme Court. So obviously the elements of Washington, D.C. are separated on this point, but she also recognized that this is not in the name of security. And in fact, posed the example that, you know, what if somebody ran for president on the basis of being anti-Jewish, and everybody in the cabinet knew that the person just hated Jewish people and eventually was elected and instituted a ban of people traveling from Israel. Would there be any way of challenging that in the courts? That was her question. And the government really, you know, shied away from that, given the fact that it shows that there is no security concern. The fact that all of these nations, the eight nations that are listed, are all predominantly Muslim, and that there are more Muslims in the world than those, does not mean that this ban was not entirely based on racism. So yes, it is certainly a false cover that the policies, both enforcement, bans, and otherwise, are to protect American citizens. And attorneys, other, you know, even academics, people who were not involved in this struggle before, are now recognizing that. And we were able to see last year the mobilization of attorneys all across the country and in airports. I did want to mention, in Baltimore, we had a very similar experience where just a couple years ago, ICE came to a school in PG, Prince George's County, Maryland, and raided the school records in an effort to find kids with undocumented parents.
My goodness.
And the very next day, almost no kids came to school. This happened again this year when one of the parents was arrested right outside of the school after dropping his child off. Myself and some other attorneys went to the school to do a Know Your Rights presentation, and I saw that only about 5 to 10 people showed up because people were so scared to leave their homes. So really, this is not creating a secure situation for anybody. It's creating a fearful situation for everybody, and it's all of our obligations to change that.
Well stated. It's a reign of terror against a targeted community
that's powerless to defend itself
because it's politically convenient for these ultra-right forces. We've been joined from Baltimore, Maryland by Heather Benno. Heather is an immigrant rights activist, and she is an attorney. And we've been joined from Chicago by Angie Kim. She's a DACA recipient, one of the Dreamers. She's the community engagement and advocacy coordinator for the National Korean American Service and Education Consortium. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our regular segment, Beyond Nuclear, where we look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States. We're joined from Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kevin Camps, the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. And we're joined in studio by Nicole Russell, who is a producer of the show and a Sputnik News analyst. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Kevin, there is so much to talk about again in this segment. There's so much happening in the country relative to nuclear waste, nuclear weapons, nuclear energy. Let's start by having you tell our listeners what you're doing in Albuquerque.
Sure. We are out here, been here since Friday, and we'll be here for some weeks because there is a proposed high-level radioactive waste dump for all the irradiated nuclear fuel from commercial reactors in the entire country. And I call it a de facto surface storage parking lot dump that's being proposed. It's called a consolidated interim storage facility. They say it's going to be temporary for 100,000 metric tons of irradiated nuclear fuel, which would make it bigger than the proposed permanent dump site at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. That's 70,000 metric tons. So about to start this evening in Washington, D.C., actually in Rockville, Maryland, is the first public meeting for environmental scoping public comment on this proposal. And then at the end of this month, early next month, out here in New Mexico, in the southeast, there are going to be three meetings in Roswell and Hobbs and Carlsbad nearby the targeted site on the Texas line, essentially, to hear what folks out here have to say about it. So the hearings are about to begin.
But that Roswell meeting wasn't initially going to be an actual meeting where people could actually speak and the public could make comments. Isn't that right?
It was going to be a poster session, and it was really upsetting to the locals down there. And they requested, hey, we want a town hall meeting too. And they asked for help from groups across the country, and we gave it, and the NRC caved. And now it's going to be a very long meeting in Roswell because NRC still wants to do its hours-long poster session where they'll mill around posters and answer your questions. And then there's going to be a town hall meeting. So it's ending up to be something like 6 hours long.
Kevin, tell us also what New Mexico's elected leaders are saying about this. I mean, I can't imagine that anybody would want a facility like this in their state. New Mexico's got some pretty powerful elected officials in Congress. Are they weighing in on this?
Yeah, they just did, actually. Both U.S. senators who are Democrats, Udall and Heinrich, wrote to NRC, I believe it was yesterday or 2 days ago, and they said, hey, you know, you're ignoring the public in northern New Mexico, which includes many Native American tribes, the biggest cities in the state, like Albuquerque and Las Cruces, and they requested two more public meetings in the north. And the NRC has not responded yet, but just today, and I haven't heard the news, Heinrich, at a Senate hearing, had, I believe, the NRC in front of him. And so he was going to get to ask the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, hey, what about these meetings up north? You know, so that's really at play here. Again, just like they've done in the past, the NRC is trying to keep this pretty much under wraps. They don't want people to know about the proposal. And we're trying to get the word out nationwide because it's not just New Mexico. It's not just northern New Mexico that's being ignored. It's even, 44 states that are along the transportation routes that this high-level radioactive waste would travel, mostly by rail, but also by barges on waterways and also by heavy haul trucks, if not legal weight trucks on interstate highways in most states.
To combat this, I know you were at the EarthFest Albuquerque event yesterday on Sunday, and it sounded like you guys had a really big turnout. A lot of people come and attend and signed letters. What's the goal of the campaign? What tactic are you all trying to use?
Yeah, it was a great day. It was a beautiful day in Albuquerque, and lucky for us because our inflatable parade float, which is a replica of a nuclear waste shipping container, was connected to solar panels that day, and we needed the sun to inflate the thing. And we had like 5,000 people pass by as part of EarthFest Albuquerque, which is a 28-year-old tradition, so it's really impressive, associated with the food co-op out here. And what we did is we had allies from the Nuclear Issues Study Group, based in Albuquerque mostly, as well as other anti-nuclear watchdogs in New Mexico. And we collected many hundreds of signatures on letters and postcards, which will be submitted to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission as official public comment, because we're in this environmental scoping phase right now that goes from March 30th until May 29th. So we have a deadline on getting public comments in. So our goal is large numbers of quality comments, and we have done this so many times. Just 13 months ago, we were doing the exact same thing against a proposed parking lot dump just 38 miles from this Holtec International scheme. It was called Waste Control Specialists in Texas, and they went bankrupt. They suspended their license application proceeding, and they are now taken over by a holding company. And they're going to probably hit the play button on their license application. So we could very well be facing two of these proposals in the same neck of the woods happening simultaneously in the near future.
And for people to be able to make comments, which is one of the goals of this campaign, should we just go to Beyond Nuclear?
Yeah, I'll get it at the top of the homepage, which is beyondnuclear.org. And for folks in the D.C. area, there's actually a hearing out at the NRC headquarters in Rockville this evening. I believe it's from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern. And you can physically go there in person and give comments, but there's also a way to take part by webinar, by call-in. And I'm going to have all the details at beyondnuclear.org.
Kevin, in the run-up to these segments, we exchange a lot of emails with ideas of issues that we want to raise. You said something in the email today that that really struck me as very funny that I want to share with our listeners. You said that the U.S. Department of Energy actually proposed cooling the Yucca Mountain, Nevada dump with solar and wind power for 300 years. Then my colleague asked them why our electricity couldn't have been generated that way in the first place, avoiding the forever deadly radioactive waste from nuclear power. DOE was so embarrassed that they never brought it up again.
Well, that colleague is Judy Treichel with the Nevada Nuclear Waste Task Force. She's been watchdogging the Yucca Dump proposal for many decades, since the 1980s, since the Screw Nevada Bill on Capitol Hill.
Right.
And sure enough, it was an artist's rendition ordered by the U.S. Department of Energy. How are we going to cool this thermally hot, high-level radioactive waste for at least three centuries until it's cool enough to maybe not cause really serious problems under this mountain? They were going to pave the mountainside, so to speak, with solar panels. They were going to fill the valley with wind turbines, and that is the way to go with our electricity supply. Yeah,
especially when a state has 330 sunny days a year.
Mm.
Well, you know, here we are. That probably happened 20 years ago, that story, and here we are with some of the biggest solar photovoltaic and solar thermal concentration facilities in the country. And maybe, you know, they're competing for biggest in the world out there in Nevada, in Southern California, in Arizona. So, you know, it's a race to save the climate. It's a race to prevent meltdowns at atomic reactors. And the way you can do all of that is with renewables.
Kevin, let's talk about a couple of the other big stories this week. We've been following First Energy, the effort to get a bailout, of course. We have to each week, because we have new listeners and for people in the Washington, D.C. area who may be listening to us for the first time, you're listening to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker and John Kiriakou. We're joined by Kevin Camps in our weekly Wednesday segment called Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps, where we talk about nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, nuclear waste, all things regarding nuclear technology. We've been talking about First Energy. The Wall Street Journal yesterday, Kevin, has this story. The article states, or the article's headline in the Wall Street Journal is, First Energy strikes creditor deal in subsidiary bankruptcies. Agreement would extricate parent company from coal and nuclear plant restructuring. And then I'll read the first couple sentences and then ask you to comment. First Energy Corp has reached a settlement with creditors of its bankrupt power generation businesses that would simplify their restructuring while extricating the parent company from the Chapter 11 case. The proposed deal with the non-bankrupt parent company requires approval from the subsidiary First Energy Solutions, or FES, and its affiliates from the Ohio Chapter 11 judge overseeing the restructuring. Chapter 11, of course, is bankruptcy. What's the significance of this?
It sounds a lot to me like a lot of First Energy self-dealing. So it's like different divisions of First Energy agree with themselves. And the whole point is to protect the mothership, the holding company, and their wealth from being a part of this bankruptcy. But other folks who are owed money, and First Energy has racked up a $2.8 billion debt, they may want their money. So, you know, it's surprise, surprise, First Energy trying to protect the mothership against folks coming for what they're due.
And why are they bankrupt? Just again, for our audience that might be hearing about this for the first time.
They've not made years worth, but decades worth of bad business decisions. Things like buying Allegheny Energy and all its coal plants just as natural gas and wind power are out competing coal on the free market. So First Energy, you know, have made these disastrous business decisions, and their response to that is not to make better decisions or to evolve with, you know, the advance of renewable energy, but to go to the Trump administration and Energy Secretary Rick Perry with an obscure law from the 1950s declaring a national emergency need to prop these failing coal and nuclear plants up with mega bailouts from ratepayers on their electric bills. So it's It's really absurd. It's really audacious. Unfortunately, the Trump administration is giving it the time of day.
Kevin, I'd like to talk about an issue that's important in Washington today. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, is in town. He addressed a joint session of Congress, which is an unusual honor, frankly. Usually it's only Benjamin Netanyahu who gets to do
that. I think Donald Trump just began adoption proceedings.
It sure seems that way.
Macron will be...
Yeah, he's the new inn leader.
Yeah, he's going to be adopted by Trump.
Yeah,
they have a special, those are beautiful pictures.
Special relationship. But one of the things that Macron said was that it's possible to renegotiate the Iran nuclear deal, which I never remember the acronym. Brian always corrects me.
Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
That's it.
JCPOA. Remember that.
With that said, Trump made a statement last night in which he essentially threatened to drop nuclear bombs on Iran. He said that that we will teach the Iranian government a lesson that very few people in the world have otherwise learned, which to me was Hiroshima and Nagasaki all over again.
Very subtle on his part.
Yeah, very, very subtle. But do you think that there is room to renegotiate this agreement? Would the Iranians be willing to renegotiate the agreement? And if so, what would that even look like?
You know, what's fascinating is all these Hail Mary passes, you know. So here is Macron sent by several European countries, and Merkel is coming later this week on Friday to try to save this deal that most folks, not everybody, of course, not the right wing, but a lot of folks agree this is a pretty good deal. And it's happening at the same time as the South Koreans, you know, and there's some credit to be had by South Korea for trying to prevent a war on the Korean Peninsula somehow. And then Trump's, you know, decision to, yeah, let's meet with the Kim regime for the first time in history. So there's all these Hail Mary passes to try to prevent war, essentially. And I guess what Macron has proposed to Trump, and given their special relationship, maybe there's some hope that it will be agreed to, is to add to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action some other components, like trying to deal with Iran's missile technology advancement, trying to deal with Iran's involvement in places like Syria and perhaps even Yemen. So, you know, it's a very dangerous time. You know, a lot of commentators are pointing out the irony of both of these crises hitting the fan at the same moment, Iran and North Korea. What is the Kim regime supposed to take from, like you said, Trump making blatant threats against Iran after a deal has been struck? Is North Korea supposed to be boosted in confidence that striking a deal with the United States will be a good thing for you? if another country that did that, Iran, is being threatened, like you said, with the worst.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely what we're thinking and hearing around here as well.
The other part of it that, again, I think it's really important, because people, if they're getting their news from the mainstream media or the corporate-owned media, they don't know some of the details. They just know Trump belligerent, Iran bad, France, I don't know what they think about France. But let's talk about what the Iranians just said, which is why Donald Trump is making these new threats. The Iranian government, or at least sectors, because it's not, you can't really talk about one Iran. There's the Revolutionary Guards, there's the government, there's the Council of State, there's the Supreme Leader. There's different centers of institutional power within the Iranian government. But there's been an argument made by at least one of those institutions that if the U.S. reneges on this deal, whereby Iran had allowed the most intrusive kind of weapons inspections to verify and to validate that it indeed was not producing weapons-grade plutonium, was not building a nuclear weapon, that if this happens to Iran, in other words, by one means or another, new sanctions are imposed on Iran contrary to the quid pro quo of the agreement. And the quid pro quo was the Western powers lift sanctions, stop this economic pressure, and in exchange, Iran allow this very intrusive inspection regime to validate and verify that they don't have weapons. That if this goes forward, that Iran will leave the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT, and the Iranian government is making, or at least this one center of power is making the argument that they have the right to leave the NPT, that the NPT isn't a binding agreement, if a country feels its national security interests are threatened by being inside the NPT, they have the right to leave. That's what North Korea did. They left in 2002, I believe, after George W. Bush declared them to be part of the axis of evil along with Iran and Iraq.
Plus, it's not like the U.S. is actually following the NPT either.
Well, that's where I'm going with this, actually. And that's what I want Kevin to help the audience understand. What is the NPT? And obviously, it says to non-nuclear powers, don't acquire nuclear weapons. That's the non-proliferation part. But there is an affirmative obligation, is there not, on the nuclear weapons powers to, instead of modernizing nuclear weapons, to actually get rid of them?
Yeah, it goes all the way back to 1968, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It's a binding United Nations treaty, the highest law of the land in the United States under our Constitution. And like you said, what it called for was the nuclear weapons powers to, in good faith, negotiate for the abolition of their arsenals. So how many? That's 50 years ago, right? So they haven't gotten around to that. The United States, Russia, the UK, France, China, and now there's some new nuclear weapons powers in the world, like India and Pakistan and Israel and North Korea. The three I mentioned, Israel and India and Pakistan, had never signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So in that sense, they were rogue countries outside of international norms. But they didn't sign because they knew they were going to become nuclear weapons powers, or at least they wanted to retain that option, and they did do it. Now, like you said about North Korea, they were a signatory to the NPT, but when they were declared a part of this axis of evil and seeing the United States invade Iraq and seeing the United States essentially invade Libya, North Korea decided that they were going to develop nuclear weapons to defend themselves, and they did very quickly. By 2006, they exploded their first nuclear device in a test, and the rest is history. And now Iran is signaling, at least the hardline elements in Iran are signaling, that they may do the same thing.
Yeah, and again, John, you'll know this because you know about how this government functions, and I know Kevin knows about it, and Nicole and I are familiar, but not necessarily experts. But I want to read, for those who aren't experts like us, why the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which puts an affirmative obligation on the United States government to incrementally begin the disarmament or ending of its own nuclear weapons program. That is not just a treaty. It's the law of the land.
You're absolutely right.
The Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution, Article 6, Clause 2, establishes that the Constitution, federal laws made pursuant to it, and treaties made under its authority constitute the supreme law of the land. That's the U.S. Constitution. And a treaty is, of course, signed by two-thirds of the members of the Senate in order for it to become a treaty. So here we have the U.S. government, and I'm talking about successive administrations violating not just international law, not just common sense, but the supreme law of the land, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
You're absolutely right. This is a violation of international law.
And, you know, there's some other treaties that the U.S. has never bothered to, you know, honor, like with Native American tribes. And one of those is the Treaty of Ruby Valley of 1863, which was signed with the Western Shoshone Nation, who happened to own the land by that treaty at Yucca Mountain that's been targeted for 30-plus years by the U.S. government for the permanent burial dump of high-level radioactive waste that would be, you know, parked temporarily in southeast New Mexico. And then the next step, now that it's been brought that far west, is to just take it a little bit further west and dump it on Western Shoshone Indian land in violation of that treaty.
Yeah, it's like we're stuck in a pattern that we just can't get out of. Once we start ignoring our own laws and the treaties to which we have acceded and have been ratified by the United States Senate, it's a slippery slope, and it just gets worse and worse, and then it becomes commonplace.
And who polices the U.S.?
Exactly.
I mean, the U.N.'s not doing that.
Exactly right.
Well, that's the thing, is that it's really up to the people of the United States to police the United States, because there's no other country is going to sanction the United States for violating international law or the NPT.
Despite the U.S. sanctioning other countries.
And the other irony here, Kevin, which can't be lost on certainly on the Iranians, is that France and the United States, Britain, I mean, these are nuclear powers that are, you know, bringing Iran to the to the backyard for a whipping, but they all have very, very large nuclear arsenals.
Yeah, you know, some good news amidst all this is that just last year, over 120 countries got together and started an official process at the United Nations to prohibit nuclear weapons. These are countries that were led by Austria, for one, who are just sick and tired of the nuclear weapons powers not fulfilling their obligation under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so what was launched was a treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. And it's slowly being ratified now by those same 120-plus countries. And it led to the Nobel Peace Prize being awarded to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, an NGO, because they played such a big role in its passage last July. So that's very hopeful. The nuclear weapons powers, like the U.S., boycotted and protested those proceedings at the United Nations. Well, you know, too bad. These other countries in the world are saying nuclear weapons are a scourge. They're going to cause our extinction if we don't abolish them before that happens. So, you know, others are getting creative using what options are available under international law to finally hold some feet to fire.
So related to all of this, Kevin, there was a study that recently got put out by experts at RAND, or they're calling themselves experts, that said that artificial intelligence could raise the risks of nuclear war. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that report?
Well, you know, the nuclear weapons arsenal in various countries is ever more automated. And we've talked on past shows about the men who saved the world, like Arkhipov of the Soviet military, Petrov. These moments when nuclear war could have been launched, and in the one case, Arkhipov's, by accident, because it was the sun rising that the Soviet early detection system mistook for missile launches, and he realized that it was a glitch, it was a mistake, and he did not run it up the pole like he was supposed to. That would have led to a Soviet counter response and nuclear war. So he saved the world that day. So now with artificial intelligence, there's talk of making more efficient and more automated the nuclear weapons responses of the United States, at least. And what are the dangers of that? Well, the dangers are if you take out the human element, there's no opportunity for an Arkhipov to save the world and prevent nuclear war. And I assume, but haven't checked the report, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, that the likes of Dan Ellsberg were not invited to this session. I think he has a little bit of wisdom to share with his colleagues about such risks.
Yeah, I doubt he was invited to rant for that.
And just so people know what we're talking about, Daniel Ellsberg, who was on this show not so long ago, has written a new book. He's the person who released the Pentagon Papers in 1970 that revealed that the U.S. government had been consistently, systematically lying to the American people about the war in Vietnam. That became a big controversy. He was initially prosecuted. He wasn't eventually imprisoned. But he's written a book called Doomsday Machine, and it's talking about when he was both at RAND and at the Pentagon as a younger person in the 1950s when he was involved in military contingency planning, nuclear war contingency planning. Kevin, why is Daniel Ellsberg, who's, you know, he's featured in full-length movies, we talk about him, why is he not at the table right now?
Yeah, I just happened to catch him speaking with Noam Chomsky at University of Arizona, Tucson. I was watching it by webinar because I'm in New Mexico, but they were great. And, you know, one passage in his book that really I found funny was that he was at the Pentagon, like you said, in the early 60s, and they skipped work, he and a friend, to go see the new opening on day one of Dr. Strangelove in the theaters. And he described it at the time as more nonfiction than fiction. And their excuse for if they got caught was this was research. And so even in that movie, they literally had the doomsday machine. You know, the Soviets had this doomsday machine that they forgot to tell the United States about, that if there's a nuclear blast, it automatically fires the full arsenal at the United States. And so through this, you know, accident and this crazy story, that's what happened. You know, spoiler alert at the end of Dr. Strangelove was, oh, they forgot to tell the United States we got this doomsday machine. So Ellsberg has so much wisdom, and he shared it last night. And I'm reminded from our earlier talk about Iran, Chomsky I caught live in D.C. back in like 2003. It was a huge 1,500-person turnout at a gymnasium. And, you know, the media didn't report it, but 1,500 people felt moved to go hear Chomsky. And his point was, there's a rule for U.S. military intervention around the world. And that first top rule is your adversary has to be completely defenseless. No ability to really strike back. That was going on in Iraq at the time. Well, you know, with Iran and with North Korea, that's not the case. They do have the ability to strike back in all kinds of ways. And so Trump, in his lack of wisdom, may not understand what Chomsky was kind of tongue-in-cheek joking about, that the U.S. bully likes to pick on countries that can't strike back. These two countries can strike back.
And in our last headline today, Kevin, we only have a couple minutes left. Tomorrow, April 26th, marks the 32nd year since the Chernobyl nuclear catastrophe began. Do you want to tell us if we've learned anything?
Well, I think the main lesson that should have been learned from Chernobyl is we have to shut down atomic reactors and build no more new ones and secure the radioactive waste that already exists and make no more. You know, there are researchers like Yablokov, who was an advisor to Yeltsin, and the Nestorenkos, father and son, who documented way back in 2004 that a million people may have died as a consequence of Chernobyl. That was their estimate. And so, you know, Fukushima happened on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl. It was really ironic timing. We had events planned already. So instead of being focused on Chernobyl, it was, what does this Fukushima nuclear catastrophe mean in light of what we know from Chernobyl? So the basic lessons have not been learned, that nuclear power has to be abolished before yet more meltdowns happen around the world.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined this Wednesday, as we are every Wednesday, in our segment called Beyond Nuclear with Kevin Camps. Kevin is the radioactive waste watchdog at the organization Beyond Nuclear. You can find out about his work and the work of his organization by going to beyondnuclear.org. We've also been joined in studio by Nicole Rossell. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.